Well, as I was doing some reading this week, I came across an analysis of the state of the church in the year 2024. And in the context of that analysis, they made a number of salient points, I think, things that we need to realize. About 80% of congregations have less than have less than 200 members, less than woo members. 10% of congregations number between 200 and 400 members. And about 10% of all of the congregations across the world have more than 400 members. And that started me thinking because I look at our numbers and sometimes I think, well, we're numbered among the 80%. We're not very big. And because of that, it can be discouraging. It's true that larger churches have a lot more resources, and because they have more resources, they can do more. But there are, as I was reflecting on all of this, some, I think, benefits to being a part of a smaller congregation. So I want to think a little bit about those benefits. And then I want to think about next week trying to not focus so much on the size of the congregation, but understand that our purpose is to uphold the truth and our purpose is to grow. And ideally, we would grow to the point where we would be in the 10% of congregations that have 200 to 400 members. And if that was the case, because we would outgrow the facilities that we have here, and maybe because we would lose some of the benefits that we appreciate here, it would be time to start another congregation of God's people. So let's think a little bit about some of the advantages that come from being in a small church. And I'll start with some that occurred to me. The first benefit that I see that comes from being a part of a small congregation is that there's a strong sense of family. You know, in the Old Testament, when the people celebrated the Passover, they always did it by family. And if you didn't have at least 10 in your family, then you would get together with another family and you would celebrate the Passover. But there were very few instances, there were times when they would celebrate the Passover in Jerusalem and there would be huge crowds of people. But for the most part, many of the sacrifices in the Old Testament were family-based. And you had to have 10 in order to be able to completely eat a lamb. And that was the goal. So I look at a statement like 1 Timothy 5, verses 1 and 2. And again, this is from the New International Reader's Version. He talks about the church as a family, in a sense, in the context of familial relationships. He says it this way to Timothy. He said, "Don't rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters with absolute purity." So, in a sense, the congregation of God's people becomes a family. You know, I guess that was impressed on me when Kim and I moved to Alaska. We moved there with just our two girls. Mandy was 5, Jenny was 3 when we moved there. And a lot of the things that belong to families, just being able to be together and to enjoy each other's company, and we do it a lot around holidays, but we ought to probably do it more than we do anyway. When we moved to Alaska, I became painfully aware that there were a lot of people there who didn't have a family. The church became their family. And for us, in particular, it was Cal and Ann Hogger. We ate every Thanksgiving dinner at Cal and Ann Hogger's house. And Kim says we missed one.
Except one.
Yeah. We missed one. I don't remember which one we missed, but
the one that we went over to the Zorn's house.
Oh, okay. The other thing that it reminded me of is it always snowed on Thanksgiving. When you went to Cal and Ann's, you had trouble getting out of their driveway after it snowed. But the church becomes family. It becomes your grandparents and your sisters and your brothers, and that's who you rely on. When we first got married, we moved to Sunnyvale, California. I was preaching at Sunnyvale, and it was a fairly large congregation. We didn't know a lot of people when we first got there, but Kim was going to cook a chicken for us. And we didn't have much money, so the cheapest way to buy a chicken was to go to the store and buy a whole chicken. So Kim got home. She suddenly realized she didn't know how to make that whole chicken into pieces of chicken. She'd watched her mother do it on a number of different occasions, and she figured she knew how to do it. Well, when it came time to do it, she didn't know how to do it. So she called one of the elders' wives, and she came over and showed her how to do it. You know, we just need that kind of family to rely on. Anybody else get that feeling that the church becomes a family? Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Oh, well, I first come here I probably spilled my guts and spoke too much. I was in trouble. But this church has been my family for a long time. It's the only family I got.
It does make a difference, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, babe. Kim. Sorry.
That's okay. God uses that analogy a lot. He talks about the household of faith. He talks about family when he's relayed. Talking about the church, even marriage, the bride, the church is the bride of Christ. And so I think it's really appropriate, and this is a great verse to kind of think about that, when we consider one another, that we consider ourselves in a very unique relationship. It may not be our physical family, but it's a spiritual family. And I think we need to, that it's demonstrated over and over and over again in the New Testament, but even in old Israel, the way that Israel was kind of constructed, the way that the Israelites before the Jewish nation, but the Israelites, even as they traveled and the way the tabernacle was set up and the way that the tribes camped around, it was all to promote that community and that family and to support one another. And so I think that it's very strong and I'll echo, you know, we grew up in large congregations. We grew up in Southern California, and we had large churches, and there were a lot of them. And so we would go from church to church and see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people gathering. And then we moved up to Alaska, and I think we had probably at the time maybe 150 people there, 120, 150.
Yeah, when we first moved there, it was about 35.
Yeah, and then it grew. But we... But we didn't know a lot of people. We didn't know anybody. And you know, our kids were little and they were in school. And so you start making associations with those people. But you don't have the same thing in common. And then we had a lot of people in the military and they were there for like 4 years. And then we had a lot of people who were with the oil companies. And they were only there for 2 years. And so we had a lot of turnover of people. And so it kind of felt like you had to envelop people and envelop them quickly. You didn't have the luxury of time to try to develop relationships. You developed those relationships really, really fast. But it was natural because you share this thing. You share a common value system. And I think that God has built us and created us for those kinds of connections and I use the word community a lot, but it's also family. Created us for each other. So we're not an island unto ourselves.
Yeah, okay. Other comments, thoughts? Well, let's look at Mark, the 10th chapter. This is a really interesting context because Jesus is with the apostles and Peter, not real surprising that Peter is the one that spoke up, but Peter speaks up and he says, "We've left everything to follow you." And, you know, in the case of James and John, they were fishermen. They had a business. They just left their boats, their nets. They left their father and they went after Jesus. So Jesus says, "Truly, I tell you, no one who's left home or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields for me and the gospel will fail to receive 100 times as much in this present age." Now, he's not talking about what we'll receive as a heavenly benefit of following Jesus, but he's talking about what we receive in this present age. We receive homes, brothers, sisters, mothers, children, fields, along with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life. What about this leaving father and mother? I must tell you, I was truly blessed. I grew up in a family where my parents were Christians. I was expected to go to church with them. I was expected to be a participant in the activities that they engaged in because they were Christians. I didn't have to face the difficulties that some people have to face when they don't have that upbringing. And I have known people who, when they became Christians, were essentially disowned by their parents. We baptized a young lady when I was preaching at Norwalk who was living at home at the time that we baptized her. Her parents kicked her out of the house that day. And she came and then lived with us, and shortly after that she got married. She had enough of living with us, but but I'm sure that all of us either have experienced this ourselves or we have friends who have experienced this and people that we know that had to give up family in order to follow Christ. Any thoughts? Yeah, Carol.
I sort of went in another direction just looking at the way you had that divided when Peter says, "We've left everything to follow you." And it's like, You're telling Jesus you left everything?
Well, yeah, that's true.
Jesus left everything.
That's true.
But the reward that Jesus got in saving souls is 100 times greater or whatever. And
yes.
He's just making sure that we know that when you give up for God, that like him, even if you suffer persecution, that you will gain much more than you lose.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't intentionally split it up that way. That's just the way it occurs. Yeah, Kim?
Well, it just occurred to me that in this, and kind of thinking about what Carol just said, that God knows that we make sacrifices. You know, we don't have to be like Peter and say, now, wait a minute. You know, I'm making sacrifices for you. But I think Peter was married. I don't know that his wife tagged along with him following Jesus across the countryside. He probably, that doesn't mean that he left his wife, but he had to leave her for periods of time, I would expect. We know he had a mother-in-law. I don't know anything more about his family. I don't know if they had children. I don't know. But he had to leave his home. So Peter rightfully is saying, look, I gave something up. I gave up my livelihood. I gave up my home. I gave up everything to follow you. And Jesus is acknowledging that and saying, you're right. You did. That, nope. You know, I get it. But look at the rewards that I have for you. And in the present age. So there's going to be a payoff now. I'm going to bless you now, but I'm also going to bless you in the future. So I don't think that Jesus is discounting this at all. But yes, I mean, how dare he? Peter, but that's impetuous Peter, right? He just keeps putting his foot in his mouth. But here Peter speaks up to Jesus, who left heaven to come here. But I also think that the way Jesus acknowledged that was he didn't deny that they had left things to follow him.
Yeah.
Left people.
Yeah. And I didn't have to give up my business. I have, and many of you know Pete Smart. He became a Christian, decided that he didn't want to be selling alcohol in a grocery store, and so he sold his business. He quit being a grocer, and that's what he knew. He was very good at it, and went in the garbage business. Didn't know anything about it, but that's a decision that he made. So I see a great benefit in small congregations allowing for this sense of family. You know, when it's pretty hard for somebody to be hurting and us not respond and rally around them, kind of like your family. Okay. Yeah, Carol.
Well, sort of along that line, I had an aunt back in Minnesota who had been sick, and we had people who picked up people and stuff. And I go, well, call somebody in your congregation. And they had like 3 services. She didn't have any family connection because she might go to one service, she might go to nobody missed her when she wasn't there. There are big benefits from a small congregation that way, because you know the person. And another thing that I thought of is that in a small congregation, you look around, there are not that many people who are going to lead songs or lead prayers or teach class or, you know. So it inspires you to grow.
Okay. Hang on to that thought. That might be something else that we could discuss. But it's a good point. And it's not just what happens in our assemblies. You know, churches do a lot more than assemble. We teach outside of this setting. And we help people outside of this setting. Okay? So don't think that what the church is this setting. Yes, you're right. There are a number of jobs that we have to do in this setting, and we don't have as many people to do those jobs. So you do have to grow into doing those jobs. Kind of like when we moved to Brookings. Brookings is a really small town. I think everybody probably knows that. It was a lot smaller when we moved there. It was about, I think Brookings had about 3,500 people, and everything was volunteer. You had a volunteer fire department. You had a volunteer police department. You had volunteer medical people. And when we moved there, we'd only been there just a couple of weeks, and I got a phone call. They said, "What are you going to volunteer for?" They wanted me to be a volunteer fireman, and I looked around and said, "No, this is living in the land of big woods, and I don't think I want to be a fireman, but I'll tell you what, I'll volunteer to be an EMT." So they said, "Great, we'll get you the training. You can be an EMT." And that was my volunteer role in that little community. So in a smaller community, you do have to grow. You do have to participate. You have to put some skin into the game, because that's just the way that community works. Ephesians 4, verse 11 through 16, passage that we read a lot, and we focus a lot on what Jesus did in building the church. But I want to focus on the kind of the last part of this. Ephesians 4, beginning at verse 11. So Christ himself gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastors, the teachers, to equip people for works of service. That's why they exist, to equip people to do service, so that the body of Christ might be built up until we reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. Then we'll be no longer infants, tossed back and forth by the waves, blown here and there by every wind of teaching, by the cunning craftiness of people and their deceitful scheming. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ. From him, the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its own work. I one time wrote an article that appeared in the bulletin where we were worshiping at that time. And I just decided that what I was going to do was pretend that the E key on my typewriter quit working. And so every time I needed an E, I would just substitute some other letter. Now you can imagine how difficult it was to read what I had written, because the E key wasn't doing its part. And I picked on E because that's the most commonly used letter in the English language. What's it? Another time, it was my job to fill out a roster of people that were going to participate in the public worship in one way or another, leading songs, being an usher, passing the Lord's Supper, all the different tasks that we have to do in the building. And we got to the point where people didn't always respond by letting somebody know if they weren't going to be there to do their job. And it wasn't a good move on my part by any means, but we got to the point in our worship when we were going to have a prayer, and I said, Joe isn't here, so we're not going to pray. That went over like a lead balloon, okay? Because typically what you expect is somebody's going to fill in. But I just decided, if you're not going to be here, we're not going to do that. It was a big mistake on my part, okay? I was young, I was stupid, and I was, frankly, I was a little miffed that I put together a list of people that were going to do jobs when we came together to worship, and people didn't even bother to let somebody know they weren't going to be there. They just didn't show up. And so that's not a good thing to say, well, we're just not going to have a prayer since you weren't here, as if you were the important person, or me was the important person. But when you think about that a little bit, you know, we have to step up and we have to do the jobs that need to be done. If we're going to take care of each other, we have to step, and I must say this church does a marvelous job. When somebody's hurting, we step up and we provide meals for them. We do things like we go over to their house and we cut the, what was it, Bob, you guys cut brambles over at Bruce's house. I don't remember what it was that you cut, but you didn't want me over there because I'd have bled all over the place. I'm not very good at that kind of stuff. But we just do what needs to be done to help people out. And some folks went over when Esther was alive and she needed help putting up a carport. Were you the one that went over and helped her put up the carport?
I helped with that, but I didn't help with the brambles.
Oh, okay. Okay. So we have to be of a mind that we're going to step up, and small congregations do that, force us kind of to step up and accept our responsibility to help the group grow. Yeah.
If you think of a body, the body communicates.
Oh, well, that's true.
And so sometimes if somebody's ignoring something and it's not telling the rest of the body, it doesn't get taken care of the way that it should. But the rest of us have eyes and observation that somebody's missing or that something's not right. And hopefully we can pick that up. When I was in a congregation up in Washington, they were talking about a young woman who had a baby within the last month, and she fell and broke her ankle like the Saturday. And they already had meals for her Saturday night and Sunday. And I mean, I don't think they had 25 people in the congregation, but because they knew the situation and they knew what needed to be done, whether she asked for it or not, they just stepped up.
Yeah, and small churches do that. We're just aware. And Kim can tell you what it's like to have to go through life with part of your body not working very well. She's found all kinds of things that she can't do. And that it's kind of job security for me. Because I'm on the bubble most of the time, but she would starve because she can't even open a jar yet. But then my grandkids bless their heart, got an automatic jar opener, and my job security went down the toilet. That was the way that I knew I was needed. Yeah.
This is kind of like group dynamics and what happens in every group. And I learned this in the business world, but you know, if it's everybody's job, it's nobody's job. So sometimes in a smaller congregation, we know the people that are willing to step up and do certain jobs. Then that means that we kind of back off and don't do them. When we could step in and do them. So sometimes and I think that's true in larger congregations especially. If it's everybody's job, it's nobody's job because you think somebody else is going to do it. In a small congregation, if you're communicating and you know each other, you might know that somebody else has already stepped up. You can back off in that instance, or you can lend a hand, or you take the lead the next time. Or, you know, I'm thinking about just trying to meet people's needs and where they are. There was something in the passage that we looked at in, can you go back a slide? That made me think, oh, to equip his people for works of service. I feel like that is really what these assemblies do. That these assemblies are really designed for the believers. They're really not designed to teach unbelievers. That's why we sometimes will do a Bring a Friend Sunday. And we try to design all of that for people who are not believers. But really, our gathering is, and the work that the elders do, the evangelists, the teachers, is to equip us to go out and do the work that we are tasked to do. So they're preparing us to do that. That means that we have to step up and do it. We've got to get out there and work. That's what God created us to do, good works. And good works is there's just a lot of stuff that falls under that category. One of them is teaching. We need to be out there teaching. We need to be out there serving other people and ministering to other people and finding out what people's needs are and trying to meet them. And then we become equipped here. Like you said, I think this morning you said that we hope we buoyed you up or encouraged you. You encouraged us. And that's what we're here for, is to get us ready to get out there and do the work that God designed for us to do. So I wanted to sort of focus on that a little bit.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. And I think small congregations do this better than large congregations. When you have, when you're blessed with, I was talking to my brother-in-law, who is an elder in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and that congregation there is 500 and something, 550 people, and they're in that church. They have, I think he was saying, five people who at one time were preaching. And, you know, in a large church like that, there are a lot of people, and it's kind of hard if you're an up-and-coming teacher to find a way to sort of say, I want to teach this class. And you're looking around you saying, there are a lot of other people that are better qualified than I am to teach this class. And so small congregations tend to make us aware of the opportunities that we have to grow. And they kind of encourage us to grow, where we wouldn't grow in a larger congregation. Yeah, Dean.
I guess I've been struggling with this entire concept. I think large or small makes no difference depending on the activities and the leadership. I'll give you an example. My children moved to Lubbock, Texas, attended a church once or twice. They found out that Kirsten was pregnant And for 2 months, Kirsten didn't have to cook. That wouldn't have happened here. It wouldn't have happened here. It might have happened for a week. Might have happened for 2 weeks. They have a multitude of preachers. You go up north, you run into different churches. I've been equated with different churches. And if you have active leadership, then your young people are put into programs. So you have song leading programs. We can't do programs in a small congregation because we have one young man or we have one young lady. Yes, there's pluses, but I guess, and I hate to even say this, my wife's going to cringe, but I'm going to say it anyway. As one of the people that's always doing in a small congregation, it's exhausting. It's exhausting to always be the shoulders that are leaned on. And in a larger congregation, you get a break. Now, if you're the type of person that's a sleeper, you just come in and sit in a pew and you're a sponge, you're just a taker, you're going to be a taker in a small congregation, you're going to be a taker in a large congregation. You're just not going to get noticed as much in a large congregation. But unless you are the type of congregation that is actively pursuing and encouraging your members to participate, and like you said, with the duty roster, we had that here for quite a while. And I was tasked with filling all those positions when people wouldn't show up, and it's exhausting. There's pluses in the fact that I can know each and every person here and love them. But there's pluses in these large congregations when you've got 15 or 20 Vickies that are making sure that your needs are taken care of after a surgery. And that's not just the ones that are feeding you, that's the ones that are organizing. So I guess I've just been kind of back here. I didn't want to be that negative Nancy, but it doesn't matter where we're at. We got things to do.
Well,
if you're in a 400 member congregation, you're going to have the same low percentage of people that are actually doing the work and a larger group of people that are just simply taking up a pew and being a sponge.
Well,
I'm kind of struggling with the concept, just a tad.
Well, I think you're right. Kim would probably agree with me. I think in any organization, 20% of the people do 80% of the work, just like 20% of fishermen catch 80% of the fish. That's true. I when I was in college, when I was an undergrad, I went to a college where it was not terribly uncommon to have 300 people in an English 1 class. Okay. So you go into a room with 300 people. If you didn't get the reading done and you weren't prepared to be in class that day, you could just kind of keep your head down and nobody would notice. And you could kind of skate. Which what you're saying is you're kind of warming a seat. And then I got to graduate school and I started going to classes where there weren't 300 people, there were 4. And if you weren't prepared and ready to contribute to that class, it stuck out like a sore thumb. Okay. And so, yeah, I see your point, but at the same time, I think there's a real encouragement when it's a smaller place to step up and do your share. And like you say, it's a lot more than what happens in this assembly. Okay. We'll go on and we're going to talk about some of the benefits of being a larger congregation next week. And we'll talk a little bit about why we want to grow. And I think all of these things have to be considered. I can look at the assembly this evening, and I can say with relative assurance, if you don't know Jesus, then it'd be easy for you to find anybody in this assembly and ask them about Jesus, and they could help you find him. That's what we want to be. That's what our assembly is. We want to be a place, like Tim said, where we equip people to do good works. So if you want to put on Christ in baptism, we'll help. If you need to rededicate yourself to being a part of his body, then we want to help you to do that.